Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about the financialization of America. In the last four decades, the financial sector of our economy has doubled in size and now takes in a quarter of all corporate profits, yet creates only about 4% of American jobs. In this presidential election and in more and more economic circles, people are questioning whether Wall Street is actually damaging the American economy rather than helping it grow. My guest today argues that the biggest threat to American economic prowess comes not from China or Asia or from illegal immigration or outside forces, but rather from our very own economic institutions. Rana Foroohar is an economics columnist for Time magazine and is CNN's global economic analyst. She formerly spent 13 years at Newsweek as an economics and foreign affairs editor and foreign correspondent covering Europe and the Middle East. She's the author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. In it, she documents the rise of finance over the last 50 years, how financialized thinking now dominates corporate culture, and how today many parts of corporate America that used to make things is now emulating banking. She also offers five areas of reform to curb Wall Street's growing dominance of Main Street. Rana Foroohar is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Rana Foroohar, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The title of your book, Makers and Takers, has come to be known in American political discourse for a certain definition, those who, I guess, suppose make money and those who take government services. But you're writing about a very different set of makers and takers in this new book. Who are the makers and takers in your view?
Well, the makers are the businesses, American businesses, that create real jobs and real economic growth. And the takers, in large part, are in the financial system. My whole thesis is that basically over the last 40 years, as the financial system, as the capital markets in America have gotten bigger, they've actually hurt American business. Now, this is exactly the opposite of what you would think would happen, right? I mean, finance is supposed to serve business. Finance is supposed to take all of our savings, all the money that we put in bank accounts, and lend it out to new businesses, the hairdresser down the street, the startup in Silicon Valley. And those businesses then grow jobs and create real prosperity on Main Street. But over the last 40 years, things have changed. The whole business model of finance has changed. And so one of the killer stats in my book, actually, is that only about 15% of all the money that is washing around the financial system ends up in businesses on Main Street. The rest of it is being traded, used to bid up stocks and bonds and houses and create the kind of asset bubbles that we saw collapse in 2008 and bring the economy down with it.
So that's 85% of all the capital in the United States is basically in this closed loop of finance, sort of changing hands and creating paper profit, but no real productivity and no value.
That's right. That's right. Well, 85% of the money coming out of the financial institutions is creating this paper wealth, as you say. It's not changing anything that's happening on Main Street. And that is one of the reasons why you have this really weird dichotomy right now where the markets are at record highs. But all of us who are living in the real world, you know, don't feel this recovery as strongly as we should. I mean, we are 7 years into an economic recovery. We should all be feeling a lot better, but many people still don't feel that recovery. They're still struggling. Most Americans haven't gotten a raise in real terms since the early 1990s. And I am arguing that one of the key reasons for that is that the financial sector itself has just gotten too big.
And it is a much bigger part of the economy. It used to be what? What was the percentage, say, 50 years ago?
Yeah, back in the 70s, it was about 3-4% of the U.S. economy. It's now 7 and change, so it's almost doubled over that time. And what's really interesting is that, you know, we sometimes have this idea, we've been sold this idea that finance is the pinnacle of the economy, right? It's where the wealth is, it's where we should all aspire to being. But there's a lot of research that shows that when the financial sector gets that big, it actually starts slowing growth in other industries because it's sucking all the oxygen out of the room. And just to throw one more interesting number at you, despite creating only 4% of American jobs, finance creates 4% of American jobs, it takes over 25% of all corporate profits. So that in itself is just a stunning number. It shows you how much of the pie this one industry is taking.
Now, as I was reading part of the book, I went back to like a middle school film strip where it sort of showed you how the American economy worked. And I can remember this cartoon image of, you know, this man who has an idea and he forms a business, and then there was this friendly banker with a pile of money that he hands over finance the business, to help the business grow so we can employ more workers. And what you're talking about is that finance was there to serve business, to help them finance, you know, building a company, building workers, you know, building the society. And the whole equation, from what I read in your book, is that that is completely switched.
It's
business
completely
is serving
switched.
Financial
I mean,
interests.
We've gone from this, it's a wonderful life model of banking, you know, to something very, very different, something very disconnected from Main Street. And what's really interesting, and I have a couple chapters on this in my book, is that businesses themselves have started to act like banks. So from the 1980s onward, the amount of money that businesses in every industry, travel, retail, manufacturing, the amount of money that those businesses get from financial activities has gone up by fivefold. It's gone up five times. So we're all bankers now. You know, companies like GE until 2008 were too big to fail banks. You've got airlines doing oil hedging. You know, it's everybody wants to be in this space because it's where all the money and profits have been, but it's also where a lot of the risk is.
Yeah. Now, before we get to the risk, you use a term throughout the book, financialization, which I think is a new word.
It is. It's a new. Well, I can't completely. I kind of stole it from some academics.
What is financialization?
Well, financialization is academics have been using it for some time to explain this rise of finance, not only the growth of the size of the financial industry, but its power in Washington. You know, finance is regularly amongst the top 1, 2, 3 corporate donors to Washington. In fact, in this political race, in 2016, this presidential race, 6 out of the top 10 individual donors to political candidates are hedge funders. So it's the power that the financial lobby holds, and it's also the way in which our entire society has begun to revolve around the markets. You know, we're all checking the stocks to see where our 401ks are. We talk about human capital, you know. We're using financialized words, and we've come to really believe that the markets know best and the markets are always going to make the right decisions for all of us. But my research and reporting shows that that's not always the case. And in fact, the interests of finance and the interests of real businesses and real communities in America are often very much opposed.
Now, one of the things that sort of, I think, one of the pieces of evidence is you did a comparison of private companies versus public companies. Public companies that have ingrained this financialization model and sometimes, many times, emulates it, or at least financialized thinking dominates the corporate life. Can you talk about the difference in productivity and actual growth of industry from private companies to public companies?
Yeah, this is one of the most startling things that I found because, you know, you look at the debate over why companies aren't investing more, why they aren't hiring more, why they're so reluctant to bring back their $2 trillion cash hoard from overseas and pay U.S. taxes on it. They talk about, well, tax rates are too high, red tape is too high. This is, you know, public company CEOs saying this. But then you look at how the private companies are behaving, and apples to apples, those private companies, many of which are family-owned and run, will invest twice as much on Main Street as the public ones will. They will invest in new factories, in new technologies, in worker training, in higher wages. You know, they will make those investments. And the public companies are not. So what's the difference? Well, the public companies have to deal with the pressure from their shareholders. And, you know, you look to go back to what we were talking about before we went on air, you know, people like Carl Icahn, like Boone Pickens, these shareholder activists, we used to call them barbarians at the gate, put a lot of pressure on companies and on CEOs to jack up their share price and to make their profits higher every quarter. But sometimes public companies and all companies need to take decisions that they may not pay off for the quarter, but they may pay off in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And I feel that the pressure from the public markets and from those types of investors is forcing companies to make decisions that are very short term and are really hindering our growth and prosperity as a nation.
Now, I know we were talking about the 1980s, and this is where you first saw it. Boone Pickett's in the petroleum industry, Carl Icahn and airlines, and probably some of those industries were a little bloated. But what has happened since that time is that Wall Street has basically continued to demand further streamlining, more profit, more profit, more profit, and that has to hinder a public company at some point. And in fact, well, you said one of the biggest things I took away from this book is that corporations are investing more in stock buyouts and stock buybacks than in research and innovation, which is goes to that idea of the private companies who are investing in research and innovation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, some of the most powerful graphics in the book and data points are, if you look at the 1980s onward, which is really when financialization began to take off, if you look at the rise of finance, as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that line goes up, 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 the amount of investment into research and development goes down, the amount of new companies being started goes down, the amount of entrepreneurial zeal in the economy goes down. And this is a real problem because one of the great things about America has always been that it's an easy place relative to many other countries to start a new business. I mean, that is one of the cornerstones of our prosperity. So when you see those trends changing, you know you got real trouble.
Mm. My guest today is Rana Faruhar, a business columnist for Time Magazine and CNN's global economic analyst. She's the author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. It's published by Crown Business. Well, in it, you sort of relate the rise of finance, and you write about a parallel that we're seeing today, say, to the 19-teens and 1920s, where really a lot of the fetters were off of financialization, and you had the same movement in the teens and 20s, very regulated after the Depression, and eventually the regulation began coming off. What was the first major steps in the growth of finance in the economy?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we often associate the growth of finance with the 80s, and it's true that it really did, you know, take off seriously then, but there were some earlier changes. I'm arguing in my book that the process actually started in the late 60s and early 70s. That's when economic growth in America started its slowing. So, you know, the post-war prosperity that we'd seen in the 1950s began to slow, and some of that was natural. You know, Europe was finally getting back on its feet after the war, and a lot of emerging markets were rising, and so we had more competition globally. But what happened was policymakers and politicians didn't want to have a real conversation about how to share the pie. It was kind of the guns and butter debate, if you remember, from back in the Vietnam War years. People didn't want to really have those conversations because they're hard. You know, you have to figure out where money's going to go of a shrinking pie. And so what they did was they passed the buck to Wall Street. So in the Carter years, interest rates were deregulated. And, you know, these weren't necessarily terrible decisions at the time. They seemed like a good idea. It helped people get homes cheaper. But then eventually that led to more complex financial products. And then deregulation in the 80s allowed companies to get bigger. It allowed finance to start doing more risky trading. That's when you really saw the rise of some of the big investment banks that were doing the kind of deals that led up to the 2008 financial crisis. And even in the Clinton years, you saw changes, the deregulation of derivatives, which are those weapons of mass financial destruction that Warren Buffett talks about, the changes that allowed the banks like Goldman Sachs to get in the business of competing with their customers, being able to hoard aluminum and drive up the prices of the cans of Coke and Coors that we're all drinking. So these changes have been over 40 years. They've been across Republican and Democratic administrations. And unfortunately, nothing got done after 2008, or not enough got done, I should say, because of the lobbying on the part of the financial industry.
Now, the other thing you do in the book is you look at how financialized thinking has come to dominate corporate life, and you use, well, one main example, GM, General Motors, how General, and really to an extent Ford as well, you have McNamara's whiz kids that came in and basically, instead of car people making cars, it was financial managers who were, okay, how can we make this widget cheaper?
And you know, right, exactly.
The result was the Ford Pinto.
I grew up in rural Indiana. My dad was in the auto components business. And so I saw this firsthand. You know, it was all about how can we make it cheaper? How can we make it faster? How can we compete with Asia? Rather than how can we just make an awesome car that Americans will want to buy? And it's interesting, one of my big sources on this part of the book was a guy named Bob Lutz, who is a former vice chairman of GM. And he wrote a book called Car Guys versus Bean Counters that really gets into this in some interesting color detail. But the key thing was that McNamara, who ran Ford, really brought that balance sheet thinking into not only the car industry, but into a lot of blue chip America and into business schools. So if you look at why CEOs make the decision to outsource a product, even though it might come back and bite them in the butt in terms of quality control or, you know, some sort of disaster. Like, I don't know if you remember the disaster in Bangladesh a few years back when a factory that was producing garments for a lot of big Western companies, including Walmart, collapsed because of safety standards. Well, that sort of thing happens when you try and outsource to the cheapest place and you don't quite know what's going on. And this is all part of that balance sheet-led thinking. And it's sadly what business schools in this country are still teaching. They still teach Finance 101, you know, marshal your capital, save your capital, put things where they're cheapest. But in this day and age, it's not money that is hard to find. I mean, companies have plenty of money. They've got $2 trillion on their balance sheets. It's human talent. It's good ideas. And so I think really refocusing, changing the narrative, thinking about what is business here to do? Is business here to serve Main Street and serve the American public, or is it here to serve Wall Street?
You write about it. Apple has so much money in the bank, and yet they're borrowing.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible. That's the lead in my book, actually, because I tried to think of the most Kafka-esque story that would really summarize how crazy the markets have become and how disconnected they are from Main Street. And what I thought of was Apple. So a few years back, Apple's stock price was starting to lag, in part because they hadn't really come up with any new groundbreaking technology since 2011, which is when Steve Jobs passed away. And so they were trying to figure out ways to jack their share price up. And one way that you can always jack your share price up is by doing these share buybacks. You come in, you spend a lot of money, you artificially inflate the price of the stock, and that makes it rise, but doesn't change anything that's happening on the ground. So Apple started doing that. They started handing back a lot of money to shareholders, people like Carl Icahn, own a big stake of the company. He did until recently. Instead of using their cash hoard to do that, they borrowed, because guess what? It's cheaper because of the incredibly low interest rates we have now, which are themselves a result of the 2008 financial crisis. It's cheaper for a company like Apple to issue tons and tons of debt, billions of dollars of debt, than it is for them to bring back the cash that they have in bank accounts overseas and pay U.S. taxes on it. And I think that's problematic for a number of reasons. One, because it creates debt bubbles, but two, because, you know, a lot of Apple's underlying technology, GPS, the Internet, touchscreen technology, that was all developed by the federal government, much of it by the division of the Pentagon that is devoted to high-tech technology. So the idea that you wouldn't want to pay U.S. taxes on something that the U.S. government helped you invest in, is it just shows you how screwed up the incentives in our system are.
Yeah. You also mentioned Hewlett-Packard, again, this very nimble company for a long time. It was sort of the hallmark of high technology. And over the last 16, 17 years, it's grown larger and larger. And today, it's a shell of its former technological edge that it was at.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's so many companies like this that have really just been worked over by the bean counters and by pressure from Wall Street. So many great American companies have cut their R&D, paid out all their cash to investors, and lost market share in the process. And actually, one of the things I'm really concerned about is in the next few years, American companies are going to be competing against a lot of emerging giants from Asia, for example. And many of those companies are private or family-owned, and they take a longer view. They take a 20, 30, 50-year view. And so it is really, really hard for American CEOs who have a shelf life of 3 years, by the way, because if they don't jack up the profits every quarter, they get thrown out. It's hard for them to take long-term decisions and really compete with those kinds of companies that have a totally different outlook and don't have to deal with the market pressure.
Now, you alluded to this earlier, this whole idea of what companies in America are built for. Are they built simply for the Wall Street investors or investors who are the shareholders themselves? It gets into the whole issue of shareholder value. What's your view of, you know, at some point, probably in the 70s, when it seems like a lot of American businesses, growth was slowing, a lot of the large companies were less than competitive, at least that's the conventional wisdom at that particular point, and shareholders made those companies a little leaner. But so there has to be a balance between shareholder value and the value of the company itself to do good in its community and in the country. So how do you get to that balance?
How do you get it? And that's a great question. So you're absolutely right. In the 70s, there was this idea that the share price would be a good way to kind of put a number on a company that leaders had to target, and that would make them make the right decisions. And you know, it's good to have a metric that people should be held accountable to, but I think it's naive to think that a share price can show the inherent value, all of the inherent value in a company. I mean, you look in the market recently at companies like Valeant, for example, the big pharmaceutical company that's had so many problems lately. It had a great share price until we found out that it was fraudulent, you know, and that it was using creative accounting to twist the numbers. I mean, there's a lot of companies that have great share prices until they don't. And so share price is only one metric. I think that you look at productivity, you look at wages. I mean, and different countries have different models. In Germany, for example, labor is paid a lot more than it is in the U.S., yet German companies are very competitive at an international level, and I would argue that that's in part because they take a longer-term view. So rather than laying everybody off after the great financial crisis in 2008, German companies actually furloughed people, kept them on, but kept them part-time or used that time to retrain folks, to help upgrade factories. And that's one reason that when the economy started picking back up a little bit globally in 2010, they stole a lot of market share from U.S. companies because they were all geared up and ready to go, whereas many of our manufacturing companies had laid people off.
Well, I think anybody who follows even casually the business pages will notice that a lot of times the share price is inverse to the news that the company's giving up. You know, when a company announces a huge company expansion, sometimes the share price goes down. When bad news is layoffs announced, the share price goes up.
I know, and it's painful. I think it's painful for people to see that, and it's wrong. You know, I mean, this happened, you go back in the mid-2000s, Microsoft did a big investment into R&D, which actually was a great idea and helped set the company up for the future. Stock price plummeted. A few months later, they announce a share buyback, stock price goes up. So I think people are getting the idea that the markets don't always know best and that the share price is not always the best indicator of what's really happening on the ground.
My guest today is Rana Faruhar. Her book is titled Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. It's published by Crown. And you have about five recommendations, general recommendations with some specific ones inside of it to maybe change this. And one of the more interesting, which you really didn't, you sort of said this is a possibility. You know, we have private savings vehicles like 401ks and private equity accounts for our retirement is a big increasing part of most American savings plans. And of course, you look ahead to 2030 when Social Security is going to be at a tipping point. And you said one of the things that could change is if you have these big investment vehicles actively looking at the asset management and looking at how the companies they hold are managed. And,
absolutely.
And for changing that towards the long view.
This is already starting to happen. You know, you see companies like BlackRock saying, wait a minute, we need to make sure that companies are doing the right thing so that the share price stays up for 20 years because, or that the actual value of the company reflects that because we're in it for the long haul. You know, you're managing people's retirement savings, and if a company crashes and they get wiped out, that's bad news for the shareholders later on, you know. And so I think you are seeing these big long-term asset managers, many of them, start to really question the system of corporate governance, question the market system and what kind of values it's really pushing. And I think that's great because ultimately the answers need to come from the capitalists themselves, I would say. You know, I mean, the power and the money in the system just needs to be redirected to the right goals to really ensure more sustainable prosperity.
One of the recommendations is in complexity, cut leverage. And in it, you ask for more daylight to everything from the shadow banking sector, a lot of the offshore stuff that's going on, derivatives trading, which should really be open to sunlight so people know what's going on in that trading. And the other thing is about leverage, cutting leverage. You were writing that says no company in America would leverage themselves 95%, but banks routinely do this.
Oh, yeah. Well, banks, if you think about it, they're doing business, their daily business with only about, you know, 5% cash or cash equivalents on the balance sheet. I mean, think about it. Can you imagine any local business having their daily operations done only 5% in cash and the rest of it in debt or complex securities or, risky assets that you can't even track globally? It's just, it's unthinkable. And we have this idea that banks are special, that they should somehow be treated differently, but they're not. They're not only just regular businesses, they're really supposed to be an intermediary. They're supposed to just help the rest of the economy. They're not supposed to be the main event.
Less debt and more equity in companies?
And amongst consumers. We have a tax code that actually supports debt. You know, it makes all kinds of debt, corporate debt, consumer debt, tax deductible. And so it encourages people to take on more debt than they really need. And this is one of the reasons we have asset bubbles. And it's also one of the reasons we have people living on credit cards and, you know, continually going from paycheck to paycheck. And if we changed the tax code and started to substitute it with incentives to encourage savings, to encourage investment, I think we'd be a lot healthier.
And rethinking who companies are for, this whole reexamination of companies run strictly for shareholders. And I never knew that there was a court case that sort of put that into law. And you tell me the story of Ford versus the Dodge brothers.
That's
goes back
right.
to 1919.
It goes all the way back to the early part of the 20th century. And it's fascinating because this was the first case that instituted this idea that companies could be legally forced to increase the share price or be held liable. And it was, I think, very wrong-headed, and we're living with the legacy of it today, and I think we need to take a broader view. I mean, yes, companies should absolutely support shareholders and the people that invest in them, particularly those that invest for the long haul, but they also need to support labor. They need to support consumers because, after all, the U.S. is a society, is an economy that is 70% consumer spending. If you don't support the people that are actually buying your products and make sure that you're creating a company and an economy that gives them more money to spend, then eventually you're destroying your own business.
Now, one of the things that comes up periodically is a way to raise money for the Treasury. It's also touted as a way to make the markets a little less volatile is a fee on trading.
I think it's actually a really good idea.
What makes that a good idea?
Well, I think that there's so much what's called high-frequency trading these days. I mean, trading that is done literally over seconds or even milliseconds. There is no social value to this. You know, yes, of course people should be allowed to trade stocks and bonds as they feel that value is going up or down. But it's really hard to argue that you're in it for anything but speculation if you're buying and selling stocks within seconds. And I think that there should be heavy taxes on that to prevent that kind of activity.
In fact, what is the term for the whole money turning around within the markets today? Is it something like 15 months, something?
It's about the entire value of the markets basically flips over, you know, once a year. And that used to be just much, much lower in the 1970s. This is something that people like Warren Buffett complain a lot about because, you know, you have 80% of the trading being done by computerized algorithms. You know, it's being done to basically make money in the markets, not to actually support the companies, and it doesn't necessarily reflect their underlying value. So it's just hard to argue that when you have a market system like that, that markets are supporting society. And, you know, if you go back to the founding of modern capitalism, Adam Smith said that financial markets were supposed to support real business. That's how capitalism works. And capitalism, by the way, is a great thing. You know, I mean, we need to make sure it's working correctly. Otherwise, we're going to end up with more of the polarized politics that we have seen here in 2016.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Makers and Takers. Rana, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Rana Faruhar is an assistant managing editor at Time Magazine and the magazine's economics columnist. She also serves as CNN's global economic analyst, and she's the author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. It's published by Crown Business. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.